From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment, the home edition. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, writer-director Emerald Fennell, is nominated for 3 Oscars this year out of the 5 that her first film as director, Promising Young Woman, has received. She's nominated as director, for screenplay, and for picture. She's one of the film's producers. Emerald, thank you so much for doing this.
Of course, thank you for having me.
Gosh, I mean, so much to talk about with this movie, but it feels like one of the things it's about, and I keep thinking about this with Killing Eve, is it's about perception and how wrong perception can be.
Yes, absolutely. I think for me, it was always about how much easier it is to manipulate perception when you're a woman, because you're almost invariably underestimated. It's an easier position to start from.
I guess I thought too, especially hearing the name Nina, it almost feels like it's the other side of Strindberg.
Oh, that's very, very clever. That was not deliberate.
Well, again, there's so much to talk about here. And I just find, again, even perception goes down to the casting. You're so often casting people against type here, starting with Carey Mulligan in the lead, but also the way you use Bo Burnham and Connie Britton and Fred Molina. There's so many ways you get to sort of play with the way we as viewers have come to know these actors, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's so much of the fun of building a world, is you have kind of complete control over who is in that world and how they live in it. It seems to me, certainly if you're making a kind of subversive film in any way, or like a satire, especially if you're kind of playing with genre, then we know that the audience has relationships with actors. We know really what those relationships are. So it feels like such a brilliant way to communicate with the audience. It didn't feel remotely strange to me to cast all of these sort of weak, selfish, disgusting men with lots of really handsome, funny, charming people.
Yeah, and I guess obviously you clearly talked a lot about the color too, but I was wondering if Pedro Almodovar was an influence on you as well.
Oh, God. I mean, probably. I think if so, probably unconsciously, but I definitely think that his kind of magical realism, or the sort of, at least the heightened allegorical way that he works, is something that I really love. And yeah, most of the films I love and aspire to, they tend to be metaphorical in some way, to some degree, and stylistic.
Well, certainly too. And also the way he uses women and the perception of women and the way women are often underestimated or disregarded and left in the margins. I mean, I guess I really felt in so many ways the impact of both in terms of color, in terms of tone. I mean, having both comic and melodrama and tragedy in the same frame. I mean, there's so much to me that feels like that.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, also, I think there's a sensibility that I really love, which is kind of bombastic. And we still have such a specific idea of how serious things should be discussed and how serious things should look. And we put an enormous amount of emphasis on subtlety and quietness and subtext. And, you know, those things are all incredibly important. But I don't mind things being more operatic. In fact, I find them much more moving if they are. I think maybe subtlety is an overrated quality in filmmaking.
Gosh, I guess I think it's funny that you're saying that, because there's a very subtle thing you do with the camera distance, the way you frame shots, but also you don't really get that close very often. And when you go close, there's a reason for it.
I suppose that stuff is in the detail. But I think the overall picture is one that has always felt to me a little bit like a fairy tale or an allegory or a sort of biblical story, sort of quite kind of straightforward in that regard and quite heightened. And of course, you know, there are lots of things and facets to this film, like there are to Cassie. But again, it's that kind of tension between how things look and how they are. And I think probably like Cassie, the film looks more inviting and sweet than it is.
Well, I guess I was thinking that camera distance being a little farther away than normal is something that, well, I guess when you get close, it starts to feel more like realism, and to make it slightly surreal, just sort of keeping it a little bit of a distance, but also to keep us a little distant from her because you're giving us information bit by bit. So if we get too close, it might feel too intimate.
Definitely. I think that she absolutely keeps people at arm's length. And so to get too close to a character who deliberately keeps people far away would feel sort of maybe invasive. Also, you know, she's an incredibly contained person. She's a deliberate person. She's still. And it was important that the camera work in this and the sort of set design had some of that formality. She is quite a formal person, I suppose. And it's really only when she starts to lose control of things. So when she starts falling for Ryan on their dates, we use Steadicam to sort of loosen things up and make them more intimate and free. And really the only other times you see that camera work is when she's losing control, when she smashes the car window after the videotape by the tree. You know, those are the moments where we loosen things up and they start to move and we feel some movement. But in general, I think the stasis is very important because she's stuck. So it didn't make sense to have a very informal shooting style.
No, but I think also in that way, the film feels as meticulous to me as in so many ways she is. And so in those moments you're talking about, when we sort of see the control go away, like when she takes the tire iron to the truck, that's the moment we actually feel a personal connection to her, or I should say a more emotional connection to her.
Absolutely. And I think that's, you know, there are lots of distance is quite important for this film because, you know, there were a lot of conversations that have been since making the film, but also, you know, in the development of it, you know, why don't we see Nina? Can we see Nina? Can we have a flashback? But the thing is about that is they give us, the audience, an insight that everyone else around Cassie doesn't have. You know, it makes her easier. It makes her more accessible, more likable. We can be more emotionally engaged. It's important that this film is about how these things often don't make you likable. They often don't make you communicative and easy to sympathize with. It's important that the things that happened in this film are a long, long time ago and that everyone else has forgotten, but one person hasn't. But if we're in her head and we see too, it's too easy. So it was always about empathizing profoundly with her and admiring her and understanding why she's doing things without losing our hearts, I suppose.
I'm talking about easy, a word I would never use to describe the film, Promising Young Woman, with the writer-director Oscar nominee, Emeril Fennell. And I guess I was thinking about your work as an actor, or even your work on writing Eve, and you're often working at these kind of dual poles of formality versus intimacy. How much do you let in? And again, we were talking about The Crown or Killing Eve. It's also about perception and maybe not really ever stepping inside what we want to know about that person.
I think that is probably true, but I wonder how much that's the case of most performance and most film. You know, you're always, whether you're acting or writing or directing, you're always making a decision about what you show and what you don't. And in the same way that I think actually in a much more considered way than in life, I love reality television and I love it because for lots of reasons, but mostly it will never stop being fascinating and also sort of slightly disheartening to see how little we conceal in real life, how obvious our motives are, how clear our body language and the way we talk is, no matter how subtle we think we're being, no matter how clever at concealing ourselves, we're not. But I think it's very interesting in a funny way that when we watch fiction or we read fiction, what we really need as an audience is to be able to kind of crack a code or sort of ferret out the truth underneath everything, when actually what's so funny about real life is the truth is so palpably obvious.
I guess it is in reality TV too, but I guess as you were saying these things, I was also thinking about, again, if we're looking at Killing Eve or Promising Young Woman, what ends up being more important than the kind of the procedural information is the emotional information. And there's a kind of a thing you like to do where you offer or you promise this idea of giving us all the facts. And by the end, the facts turn out to be not nearly as material as we think.
Yeah, I think that is the case. I mean, certainly with something like Killing Eve, that world and the sort of dynamics in that world was set up so beautifully by Phoebe Waller-Bridge and Luke Jennings, who wrote the books as well. And so up to a point, I was taking the reins on that one. But I do think that it's the same in all of our lives, isn't it? You know, the procedure of how things work or how we get from A to B really is interesting as our emotional interaction with them. And the thing that I've always found fascinating about Killing Eve isn't just the relationship between those two women, but it's the sort of minutiae of everyone's life. But the fact that if you are a spy or an assassin, you still have to go to the loo. You still have to cook dinner, do the laundry, whatever it is. It's those are the kind of moments that are interesting, I think, there, that it was always like with the opening of the second series, which was the one that I wrote, it starts immediately after the stabbing of the first series. And we didn't do what you would expect and what you would normally see in this kind of genre, which is cut to 6 months later when everyone was healed and everything's fine. What we did was kind of dwell in the space that I find incredibly interesting. I mean, it's arguable whether anyone else does, but what happens after you stab someone when you're a real person? How do you get home? What do you do with the knife if you find out you're waiting in the queue and your coat's about to go through a scanner at the train station? Where does the knife go? Oh, well, if you're a woman, then the first place I would hide it would be a sanitary bin where people put their Tampax, because no one ever looks in there. You know, these are the kind of, you'd need sugar because you'd kind of have a hangover. So you'd eat like you were on a hangover and shock. So you'd get like so much candy that you, like an insane person. It's those sorts of that behavior, that the aftermath of things, it's just as exciting to me as the sort of big event itself. It's how we cope with those things.
Oh my gosh, you're talking about what reality TV is, which is we're always stuck in the aftermath of some horrible event and watching people trying not to shake or sweat. And those beats that you're talking about are really that much of a part of that second series of Killing Eve. But also in Promising Young Woman, each point where the imposture disappears, we're left with all these people who are stuck with, what do I do? I mean, it's funny you say reality TV, because those moments in reality TV where the camera just fixes as almost like a really anxious portrait of the person who's talking to the camera, you do that to some extent in Promising Young Woman.
Absolutely. And I think Promising Young Woman is all about the aftermath of something terrible, and a long time after too. I think, again, it's one of those things that when you kind of look at the genre and the way that we played with the genre, there's usually an inciting incident that you have to see that is very horrible, which is maybe what you would expect when you see this drunk woman in the club. You're expecting to see the thing that's going to start everything off. What you're not expecting is that thing has happened a long, long time ago, and she's finding a very perverse way of trying to rectify it. So I think the aftermath is, it's very rarely dwelt on, actually, because we want to see action. That's how we're kind of primed. And that's not to say I don't think there is action in both of these things, in Promising Young Woman and in Killing Eve. There's an enormous amount of action, but how do you reassemble everything afterwards? How do you move forward? How do we all react differently to things? That's the thing that I find most interesting.
Gosh, it's so funny all these things you're saying, because we're clearly with somebody, with Cassie in Promising Young Woman, who has not let go of the past yet and has been doing this for so long that, for example, when she's making herself up in the mirror. She's not even really looking at herself anymore as much as she's looking at what she's basically trying to create an effect. Everything she does is either to be seen or not to be seen. And she's very specific about all those choices.
Absolutely. And I think that's the first lesson, I suppose, as a woman, is learning how to disappear or learning how to attract attention. Those are the two things you're taught, really. And so it makes total sense that she would be expert at that thing. And, you know, most specifically kind of being chameleon-like in the way that she can transform herself. And me and Carey talked a lot about addiction with regards to this film and self-harm. And I think certainly the pattern of behavior that Cassie follows with her kind of nighttime excursions are akin to that kind of thing. There's a buildup of tension which needs to be released. And then that's followed by a moment of elation, which is then followed by kind of shame and self-loathing, and it sort of starts again. I think that was something that felt very truthful about being in this kind of position.
Well, clearly there's a lot to talk about with my guest, Oscar nominee and reality fan, Emerald Fennell. Her new film is Writer Director. Her debut is Promising Young Woman. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Treatment. My guest, who shouldn't be on her own in a box, is Emerald Fennell. She's writer, director, producer of the Oscar-nominated new film, Promising Young Woman. One of the things I was thinking about, too, with this film, and I wanted to ask you about this, is that it feels like it's at a certain point we're watching somebody whose ego died a long time ago. Because we were talking in the first half about how she knows how to either be seen or not be seen. I don't want to say sense of mission, but when this incident that set her life into this path it's on now, or in the course of the film, it was that part of her died.
That's so interesting. I mean, I probably reveal my very, very limited knowledge of the concept of the ego, but from what I know about it, I'm not sure that's the case. I actually think Cassie is of the personality type that I think she does have an ego. Part of the things that she does are to give her power and to make her feel power over people and to see them frightened. And I mean, I don't know whether what that specifically is, but I think that's not somebody with no ego. I don't think that's the response of a person with no ego. Yes, this quest that she's on is seemingly a selfless act, but I think the truth is that it ceased to be that a long time ago. It's now a need, because it alleviates the grief and the pain for a moment, and it alleviates it because it's intoxicating, because it's pleasurable. You know, not always. That's not to say that there aren't times that we don't show in the film where these things go wrong. And I think that's probably the danger is regrettably sort of a part of it. But when you're a woman like this, or really any woman, you so rarely have power in a room alone with a man, and you know, you do not have the physical attributes, generally speaking, required to do what a man might do in that situation, which is why, you know, in this film, when violence is introduced, it goes the way it does. So to feel, to give somebody else, I suppose, the like ego death, I don't know if that's the right sort of phrase, but to see somebody else realize they're not a good person, to see somebody else's idea of themselves shatter, is what she's doing. And yes, it's broadly helpful. Yes, it will possibly stop those men from doing it again, which is how she can justify it to herself. But I think that she enjoys it. And I think I would enjoy it too. I'm not saying for a second, I'm just saying in the moment, that's what she's doing.
Because I guess I wanted to ask you if she was doing this because she was trying to make everybody feel the way Nina must have felt. Which is not to say that there's not, I mean, there's not pleasure to be taken from just this way that she submerged herself. I mean, she even drives this car that makes her invisible, this pale blue beat down Toyota. So with the kind of investment she's made in this thing, which is certainly solipsistic, but not to say is without worth. But I guess I was thinking about this not in terms of power, although there's certainly power to be derived, but this obsession that's, I guess, kind of like an addiction to make all these people who did this to her friend feel the way she must have felt.
Well, I suppose the thing is that there are two very distinct kind of paths for her with this film, because when we find her, the thing that she's been doing, which is sort of, which is with strangers, I suppose, is different. The reason, I suppose, the thing that happens in this film that has, that changes everything is meeting Ryan and realizing that she has to address the thing that she hasn't been looking at, the actual people, the real root of it. And I think once she does that, it's a different relationship. It's something much darker and more upsetting. And yes, I think that the lesson she's trying to impart is much more specific. And it is very much, you didn't believe it. Well, let me show you how it feels. Do you believe it now? It's a different experience for her and for them, I think, what she's doing. And inevitably it is sort of more out of control.
It's a treat when we're talking to the writer, director of the Oscar-nominated film, Promising Young Woman, Emerald Fennell. I guess this feels to me like it's an ideal project for someone who is an actor, because it's about trying to set these things into motion between performance and persona and not giving too much away. I was wondering if those were the conversations you had with Carey Mulligan about doing this. I mean, it feels like, to me, this is best suited to be in the hands of somebody who has acted before.
That's very interesting. I don't know how much of that was conscious, but I think you're probably right. I'm very preoccupied with the appearance of things and how they can be, how easily they can be manipulated. But when it comes to Carey, the reason I think that she's so amazing is that she is much less preoccupied with the part that's being played. The part that's being played and the costume that's being put on is only ever a kind of surface to what's really, what I think is so genius about her performance, and what was so, why I wanted her desperately to do it, was because she's never really playing a part. She's going through the motions, and she's kind of a bit like putting the makeup on, as you say. She's sort of, she knows how to do what she does, but the pleasure for us as an audience is actually seeing her all the time. It's the little moments where, you know, as an example, when she's at Neil's apartment, Neil's played by Christopher Mintz-Platz, and he asks if she wants some Coke and she says no. And then he tries to make her snort it and she sort of blows it away. And then finally he puts his finger in her mouth and rubs it in her gums. And it's one of my favorite moments of the whole film, because the way that Cassie looks at him is the most furious I've ever seen anyone look at anyone. But it would be impossible for Neil in the world to say she was looking at him in any strange way at all. It's the most pure look of hatred possible for any human to give, and you wouldn't notice it. He's giving it to you. And I think that's what's so genius about what she does, is we know what's happening, even if it's not in any way signposted.
Oh my God, there's so much going on with his conversation about Consider the Lobster, which I guess he seems to think is a novel, and the and the Duvivier and Fellini posters, which are also giveaways about the way women are treated too. And I think what's, for me, such a wonderful thing in her performance is when the switch goes off, her physical posture changes. The first thing I notice is the way her shoulders go down when she's not doing this sort of act anymore, and the sense of relief. In addition to all these other things, is like, oh, I don't have to do this anymore. And it basically happens at that moment you're talking about, that kind of weird tension that she uses to wire herself up just kind of goes away when you just see her complete contempt for him.
And she relaxes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It is the same as having a drink. It's the same as, you know, what it is when we buy something, if we're addicted to shopping or we eat something. It is such a relief. Because, and it's also an anticipation, I think, of something kind of both inevitable and unknown, something both pleasurable and incredibly frightening and dangerous. It's just, it's all of the things that, yeah, that we feel when we feel alive. It's that kind of, she's back in the room.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I really find myself attracted to in this performance, and you get to, I wonder you talk about this a little bit, is that this is a really physical performance from Carey, isn't it? A really physical performance.
You know, again, the thing about Carey that's so interesting as a performer and as a person is that she is not method. She is not...
Wow.
Driven person. She didn't speak in an American accent at all, except for when we were filming. She didn't, you know, we talked a lot. We talk a lot about Cassie. We talked a lot about Nina. We talked about addiction and pleasure and fear and all of those things, of course. But she comes to set. She's there all day. She never goes to her trailer. She hangs out with everyone. She has lunch with everyone. She is at her own stand-in unless she has to change or whatever. She's completely present, completely adorable, completely herself until, you know, the camera starts rolling. And it's like, it's quite chilling. It's like watching somebody be possessed. And I think that it means that whatever it is that happens with Carey is completely unconscious. And that's not to say it's not, that she's not incredibly diligent and hardworking. She is, but it's a sort of, it's just an innate understanding of the thing that's happening. And it also usually requires somebody else to be, you know, she's in the room with the person and it's startling. And so all of the physical, you know, all of it is just, it's something that happens. And it's always right because it's completely intuitive because she's just there in the room with the person, which is quite unnerving sometimes because she's, you know, 2 seconds before been hilarious and adorable and then suddenly she's terrifying.
Wow. Well, that's probably a good place to end, although I'm sorry we're out of time. I can't thank you enough for doing this given all of our technical problems here. Thank you again, Errol, and good luck in a few weeks.
Of course. Thank you so much. And thank you for such an unbelievably interesting conversation. It's just been such a fascinating conversation.
No, well, it's a fascinating movie and a completely incredibly confident piece of filmmaking. So thank you for that. Barb, thanks again to our guest, Emma Fennell, who's an Oscar nominee for screenwriting, directing, and picture. Two of the nominations for the film Promising Young Woman, our recording engineer, who is also part of our technical staff at KCRW, is Paul Smith, along with Desmond Taylor and Kat Yore. The show was edited and produced by Rebecca Mooney. To better days, everybody. I'm Elvis Mitchell. That's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.